Me he desconcentrado un poco. Les decía antes que les agradezco mucho que hayan venido, sobre todo porque el GEI nos ha contraprogramado con Barico y que intentaré, por mi parte, sacarle el máximo de partido a Tommy para que, en fin, les merezca la pena haber estado con nosotros y no con la estrella del festival. El autor que tenemos hoy aquí tiene un éxito apabullante en el mundo. Ha vendido más de 200.000 ejemplares en Holanda, lo cual supone, en fin, es como proporcionalmente a la población, es como si es un bestseller de máxima categoría en un país tan pequeño. Y se ha vendido a muchísimas lenguas y existe una traducción en español que publica el Grupo Planeta en su sello Destino y que se llama Las Andanzas, creo que la traducción que pusieron fue Las Andanzas de Joe Speedball. El libro es, si les cuento por encima qué es el libro y les digo que es la historia de un adolescente que tras un coma solo mantiene la movilidad en un brazo y que está prácticamente inmóvil y que tiene un amigo con el que consigue más o menos salir a la vida e incorporarse a una vida, digamos, llena de vida y emociones, ustedes podrían pensar que se trata de un libro ñoño, inspiracional, y es justo lo contrario. O sea, si quieren un libro de humor blanco y de buenos sentimientos, este no es su libro. Tiene cierto optimismo, pero este libro es más bien lo contrario. Es una historia en la que no se escatiman ninguno de los elementos negativos, oscuros, de personajes que tienen rebeldía, un poco de rencor y que no son necesariamente paradigma de lo que hoy entendemos por virtudes. Con esta pequeña presentación, no digo más para poder alimentar un poco la conversación, ya se planteaba una cosa que le comentaba un momento antes al autor, y es una obra de ficción. Estamos muy acostumbrados y, en fin, somos bastante partidarios a que la novela surja de la vida, de una vida más o menos convencional, relatar personas normales, y ese es un poco el sentido de la novela americana, que nace de la clase media, de la novela norteamericana. Y aquí encontramos una novela con ficción real, donde el punto de partida es una persona que está incapacitada, que ha tenido incluso pulsiones suicidas y que está en ese tránsito de la infancia, última infancia, adolescencia a la edad adulta. Está en ese tránsito tan siempre tortuoso y doloroso que todos, en mayor o menor medida, hemos sufrido. Entonces, la pregunta necesaria y primera que le tengo que hacer a Tommy es ¿cómo se le ocurre el punto de partida de alguien que tiene como única parte móvil del cuerpo un brazo?
The book actually started with the name of the book, with the character called Joe Speedboat. When I studied in the north of the Netherlands, I studied history, but I was mainly drinking a lot and playing rugby a lot and not studying at all. And suddenly one of my very strong ice hockey playing friends said, well, I know a boy who's called himself Joe Speedboat. And at the time, I thought it was a funny anecdote, somebody who didn't want to be called Jan-Peter van der Veen, but renamed himself Joe Speedboat when he was 12 or 14. And years later, I forgot all about that, but then I was searching for a new novel to write. And suddenly this name, Joe Speedboat, appeared again. And I thought, well, what is exactly the energy around a name like Joe Speedboat and somebody who calls himself Joe Speedboat? And I thought he was a magician of movement, a kinetic magician. And I started to invent everything that would belong to a character that was called Joe Speedboat. And I wanted him to write, to tell the book. And I started off writing it with him as the main character, with him as the narrator. But then I realized that somebody who is a kinetic, a very vibrant magician, is not able to tell his own story. He's way too active for that, too vital. And these chapters I wrote with Joe Speedboat as a narrator weren't very good. I still have them. They're not good, not at all. So I needed somebody who was in a more secluded, silent position in order to watch Joe Speedboat and his magic actions. And suddenly it dawned on me that it could be somebody in a wheelchair who's not able to be part of life, be part of our social actions. Somebody who has indeed actually the position every novelist like to have, being in the heart of the action but not influencing it, like the fly on the wall position. And with this boy who cannot speak, who's been in a coma for almost a year, and who has only his right arm to use, I thought, well, he is, so he can write down his diaries, and his diaries are actually this book. I thought, well, he is a perfect narrator. He is the one I need. He's the one who is actually if Joe Speedboat is the prophet, he is an apostle.
No, por ir desgranando un poco el libro, cuando este adolescente se encuentra en su estado convaleciente, aparece este otro personaje, Joe Speedboat, que es un personaje entre luminoso y oscuro, que, en fin, que digamos que tiene una cierta resentimiento con el mundo, rebeldía con el mundo, y que es capaz de hacerlo todo. Es capaz de volar una escuela o es capaz, que ha dicho el señor Martínez, de fabricar un avión para que su nuevo amigo, de un modo, puedan ver, comprobar si una vecina se desnudaba o no se desnudaba y poder haber, en fin, y tener así juntos sus primeras pulsiones sexuales. Entonces, esta dualidad de la que hablamos ahora entre los dos personajes, en el que uno es más reflexivo, las reflexiones vienen siempre del narrador, obviamente, que además, por su estado, es muy adecuado en la novela, y la acción que siempre se produce a través de ese otro personaje. De estos dos personajes, ¿cuál es en tu adolescencia, que no sé si fue muy tortuosa o fue una plácida, pero con cuáles te identificas más? Porque los dos tienen en común cierta rebeldía, cierta digamos, lucha contra el mundo, que no les, el mundo les es un poco ajeno por motivos diferentes, ¿no?
Well, a coming-of-age novel with characters that actually protect the order of the world would be very difficult to write. A coming-of-age novel, you need some revolution, a spark of revolution in your characters. And the question with whom I identify more is difficult to answer, because it's like, well, maybe it's like asking you, a parent, which one of your children do you like more? Well, for some parents it's not so difficult to answer, but my parents know the answer, that's for sure. But I think the position that Fransje Hermans, the boy in the wheelchair, is in, is very much, was very much mine when I was a teenager. I felt completely unable to change a thing. I felt completely inept and lost. Not being able to influence anything or to make people like me, or so writing about him, writing from his perspective, was actually very easy. Every morning when I got to my writing table, it was very easy to pick up this tone of voice which he has, which some critics reminded of Holden Caulfield, which is a bit too simple, but it's that how would you call it? The tone of voice. The tone of voice. How would you call it? Edgy. Edgy is probably the word. And it's very, to me, it's very natural. So it's probably, it has a lot of to do with myself. And Joe Speedboat, as somebody who, a boy who's into kinetics, who's into building airplanes and bombs and making an arm wrestler of this one-armed boy who has this enormous arm. That's probably too active for whom I was. I wrote diaries until I was 25. I was in this very neutral position, just reflecting. And I only started acting when I was starting to play rugby and try to be more of a part of the world.
No, no quisiera llevarlo demasiado al extremo, el paralelismo con lo biográfico. Pero hay otra cosa que me parece muy interesante de la novela.
But you can.
Que es el hecho de que viven todos los personajes, no solo estos dos personajes, viven atrapados en una población rural holandesa, y que ese es un poco también incluso hay un personaje, quiero recordar, que viaja al extranjero, no sé, una chica, y cuando vuelve realmente no ha entendido el mundo, ¿no? Realmente son personajes que están todos como en una jaula de pájaros, de la que se quieren escapar pero no saben cómo, ni saben. Entonces realmente ese mundo opresivo holandés lo conoces, lo investigaste, forma parte de tu propio pasado, te interesaba solo como espacio narrativo para que los personajes estuvieran en fin, más aislados del mundo.
So no biographical notes anymore. Okay. That's difficult. No, but the character.
Aún no hemos llegado al sexo, ¿eh?
The character of Joe Speedboat never occurred to me as somebody who's trapped. I mean, he builds an aircraft to see his naked neighbor, who sits in the sun naked, but there's a wall around the garden, so he thinks, well, we need an aircraft just to get above the garden so we can watch her. So he doesn't seem very trapped to me. And but of course, when you're from a village, and I know a lot of villagers, I grew up in a village, you always meet villagers with ambitions that are actually too large for their background. There's something tragic about them. For instance, I knew a rugby player who always wanted to travel the world, and he was always comparing travel anecdotes with me. And finally he got to make his own, his large trip around the world, and he would be gone for 2 years. And he got to Sweden, met a girl and stayed there. Never got further than Sweden. I mean, that's tragic. You can get the boy out of the village, but you can never get the village out of the boy. So that's the state of mind of most of the characters in Joe Speedboat. But here is Joe Speedboat, and he is, of course, as a prophet, he promises new worlds. He promises change. Yes, we can. No, you cannot. Yeah.
Ahora quería entrar en el, antes de entrar en el amor, porque en la novela también hay una suerte de triángulo amoroso, porque así como les he dicho que el libro no tiene componentes, o para mí no encuentro componentes inspiracionales, la verdad es que el juego que da el personaje que está postrado y que tiene solo un árbol, de un brazo de movilidad, pues se enamora de una chica que obviamente entre esta relación que tienen los dos, es al final es la chica de la que los dos se enamoran, y entonces hay una parte amorosa en la que quería entrar, pero como pasa muchas veces, antes del amor hay que ir al sexo. Y entonces los personajes viven, hay un cierto descubrimiento en ese tránsito que decíamos de la adolescencia, la madurez, a una prematura o presunta edad adulta. Hay algo de escape, de vía de escape, que es el alcohol. Esa es una. Y luego hay otra que es una, uno de los elementos comunes a los personajes, que es el sexo. Entonces, es muy difícil en la literatura convencional, que no pretende excitar al lector, es muy difícil describir el sexo y las pulsiones sexuales. Entonces, quería saber cómo se enfrentó Tommy a la hora de tener que retratar ambas cosas, tanto el sexo como las propias pulsiones, como el deseo en sí mismo. ¿Cómo te
Well, going back to the teenager's mind is not so difficult. Every time that you meet somebody you like, you're back to your teenage years. With the same nervousness, well, a few tricks here and there, but with the same nervousness and the same feelings of not being able. And it was very intimate to write about Frankie in his wheelchair and how his desire was actually not going to meet fulfillment, never, for a boy like him. There are trained prostitutes, but love, never. And the great twist in the book, which makes it a very hopeful book, is that this female character looks at the boy in the wheelchair and reads, she's his only reader, he writes down everything that happens in his diaries, and she reads his diaries, he lets her read the diaries, and he's not able to speak, but he can speak his mind in his writing. And in his writing, she sees his great intelligence. And that's what a writer wants. He wants to be recognized by somebody to see his brain for what it is. And she, at a certain point, says, well, intelligence is very sexy. And suddenly, this gorgeous woman starts to, well, what does she do? She has sex with him in their own funny way. And she says, well, you might be handicapped, but not there, my young friend. So, but it was very, very difficult. And I interviewed quite a lot of I did a lot of interviews with a handicapped friend of mine, whom I thanked in the book, in front of the book, called Rutger Boots. And I think because I think the facts have to be right, so that's why I put a lot of research into my books, and I spend probably 2 weeks with him, interviewing him and walking with him and seeing how people respond to somebody in a wheelchair. For instance, somebody in a wheelchair is always his eyes are here and people are up there. And when he's not able to pronounce properly, people will think that somebody is wrong with your mind, whereas his mind is a pearl. It's perfectly sparkling. So all these things I discovered whilst being with somebody who had a severe handicap. And I totally disagree with somebody like E.L. Doktorov, the American novelist, who once said in an interview, he said, well, if I want to know how somebody from the mafia puts somebody with his feet in cement and after that drops him in the river, I don't go, oh, how do you do that? You don't go over to somebody from the mafia and ask how he does that. And I thought, well, yes, I want to know how he does that. Please do your research, man. But he was very principled about, no, you make it up. You use your imagination. But the problem is, if you have that perspective on fiction, you never get further than the imagination of your spokesman, the novelist who's telling you the story. And I want to get behind my imagination, for it is limited. Yes. Answer.
Ahora él va a leer un pequeño texto de su elección del libro y que espero que os guste.
Only one page. Okay, good. Yes, I don't know what page. She's shouting in my ear. Yes, 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 mother. yes, let me read something from his perspective and how he got in his wheelchair. Yes. My thoughts went back to the years before I'd met Joe, before I'd led the world behind for 220 days. So many questions back then, so many that it made me dizzy. There had to be more to it than this. I was sure of it. People couldn't really be content to live and die the way they did. Some secret was being kept from me, something they knew but weren't telling, something 1,000 times more real than this. Wondering why, they say, is the start of all philosophy. For me, it was the start of a kind of hell. No whys about it, Pa would say. That's just the way it is. And when I kept asking, he would smack me up against the side of the head. He was the wrong person to ask, in other words. But that didn't mean that there was no answer. I wasn't too ignorant to know ignorance when I saw it. So I waited. Somewhere a door would open, someone would explain how it went, and... Oh, sorry, did I tell you the page? But do you know where it is? Oh, sorry, yes. And what are you talking about then? Oh, you're translating. Oh, wonderful. Okay, it's page 102. I suddenly realized that I left you in the dark. But you got it, yeah. Wonderful, good job. Are you there? Are you with me? Yes. Yes. The last sentence was it's halfway the page. I wasn't too ignorant to know ignorance when I saw it. So I waited. So Somewhere a door would open, someone would explain how it went. And until then, let's see. Yeah, so I waited. Somewhere a door would open, someone would explain how it went, and until then I would keep my eyes wide open and keep asking why. People, I knew, like to think of life as a stairway. You started at the bottom and kept climbing as life went on. Nursery school, kindergarten, and then primary school, where they told you that higher education was the answer. That's where you'd find out about the things you couldn't see from here. I believed them, but I was consumed by impatience, so I went on asking why, until it started getting really irritating. In their eyes, I wasn't just being cheeky, overplaying my hand, as though I was asking to speak to God himself. I wouldn't want to pretend that I, with all those questions of mine, was the kind of kid you'd have found endearing, more like autistic. Back then, my thinking had an aggravating severity to it that I've never ever approached since. The same kind of bare-bone austerity I later came to admire in the philosophy of the samurai. And the answer didn't come. I'd expected a lot from high school, biology, history, literature. That's where it was all going to happen. It had to be buried somewhere inside that pile of books I lugged around each day. But the books spoke with the voices of teachers, or the teachers spoke with the voices of books. How that worked was never quite clear to me. They taught me skills, but provided no answers. Until then, my why had always been referred on. But this, for the time being, was where the buck stopped. This was where I was going to stay for the next 5 years. These same mouths would speak to me the whole time, and to my horror and dismay, I discovered that my question wasn't particularly popular here either. Things were what they were, and it didn't do to go poking around in it too much, just like Pa said. I caught a glimmer of an abysmal truth. The people here wanted to pass the time as comfortably as possible without having to deal with questions that had to be answered with a simple yes, no, or I don't know. No one around me was doing anything except the best imitation they could of what they'd seen other people do before. Parents imitated their parents, kindergarten teachers other kindergarten teachers, pupils other pupils, and clergymen and educators each other and their books. The only variation was in what they forgot to imitate. None of them knew the way. Rank amateurism was all it was. And I lay awake at night, my eyes wide open, more afraid of the things that weren't there than of the things that were. Some people say they were born in the wrong body. I, however, was born not only in the wrong body, but also in the wrong family, in the wrong village, in the wrong country, and so on. I read a lot, and in those books, I thought I sometimes perceived a shimmer of light. I devoured every book in the Lomarg library, except for the large print section. When I discovered the samurai, I was impressed by their Spartan self-discipline. They at least saw the need, when you had lost your honor and life was rendered meaningless, to stick a knife in your own belly, seppuku, the clean, straight cut you could never practice, because the first time was also the last. More people should give it a go. At church, I sat in the back pew playing cards, while up in the front, Nieuwenhuis was saying, "He that searches for the truth comes to the light," but I still couldn't see a thing. Nieuwenhuis's conviction was born of the need to be convinced, that much was clear to me. But exactly what he was convinced of was less clear. Repression was the only thing that could have kept that trap spring loaded for 2,000 years. But now that the internal combustion engine and social democracy had taken out of the tension out of it, you saw repression making way for tolerance and guitars in the church. It was like the way old people who had been real bastards all their life would suddenly break down and weep over nothing when their number was almost up. You know what I mean. Looking back on it, I think I wasn't even searching for the truth or anything, but for something that shed a little light. My first year of high school was one huge disaster. It made me sick. Everywhere I looked, I saw mediocrity and submissiveness and an innocence that ruined everything because it meant no one could really help it. If we were, in fact, the measure of all things, what hope was there of redemption? By the end of my second year, I was furious. A long vacation followed, and I watched July go by. Then August came, and I waited for nothing. I lay on my back in the tall green grass that was already turning yellow. The dryness rustled. Little bugs crawled over my arms and legs. I let them. Somewhere, I heard the pounding of a galloping horse. The corn was still half high, and the rust-brown sorrel stuck out above me. I looked up at the blank sky, a lovely blue and all, but otherwise nothing. Growling monotonously, a little plane crossed the void. At the edges of my vision, the woolly thistles were bursting their buds. Butterflies fluttered aimlessly, and I had the feeling I was sinking. I sank to a dark and quiet place. It was a day for cyclomowers. I must have heard it, the tractor pulling the snapping blades, cutting through grass and flowers. Whack, whack, whack. No sleep so deep that you would not hear that. Who could fail to hear the roar of 190 horsepower John Deere? Who would lie down and sleep in the grass at mowing time? Who would do something like that? Then you've got only yourself to blame. You're right, all of you. Who would lie down in the grass at mowing time? Thank you so much. How is it time-wise? 6:15. Yeah, I'll do one more page because this explains. I just read it for the first time in 5 years, about an hour ago in my hotel room, and I thought it was quite good. So. I'll try. It's a vision he has. The front wheel of the tractor crushed my sternum and broke my back, but the blades missed me. The man up on top saw me, but too late. Some call that luck, others misfortune. Musashi says, the way of the samurai is the unflinching acceptance of death. As to what happened afterwards, I can only guess. Although I was clearly on my way to the end, sometimes I think I waited for some reason to come back, a single reason to grasp a branch along the river of death and start in on the road home, inch by inch, back to where I came from. Maybe Joe Speedboat was that reason. That was a long time ago, and I can't really get to it anymore. I was too far gone for clear-cut memories. Sometimes it's too far away, and it seems as though I made it all up. The tractor, the dream of the hero, the return to that brighter place. The memory of my dream time. The body floats just below the surface. There is no pain, no one is missed. Close to the surface, where the light breaks through the water, it is clearer. You can taste the sun. Look, someone says, he's dreaming. The hero's dream. A hero will come. The sound of his heavy footsteps precedes him to those who are outside go in and close the doors. Heroes never bring only good fortune. It's cold. We smell wood smoke. It tumbles from the chimneys and mixes with the mist that has settled over the fields and roads. The newcomer whistles a quiet song. He will bring good cheer and sow confusion. He bears new times like a sword. He will shatter our illusions and break through our terse backwardness. His feet will bring beauty, but we will chase him away. This is no time for heroes. There are hands that lift you up. There are hands that put you down. The body approaches the surface. It has grown lighter, a little lighter all the time. That light, oh hell, it breaks through my forehead like a thermal lance. I am born for the second time. blind and helpless, I wash ashore. Around my bed, they're talking about Joe. Thank you.
Fantástico.
In Germany, they can listen to you for an hour.
They can't.
They can.
Ah, they can.
They just sit there and listen. They're used to that, you know. And in Holland, 10 minutes. How is that in Latino America? Yeah. How long can you sit and listen to somebody read from a story? Well, you're not from Latino America. You're from America.
No, yo creo que aquí en el mundo hispano yo creo que una cosa intermedia entre los 10 minutos holandeses y la hora alemana. Una hora seguro que no. Aquí en Latinoamérica no aguantamos una hora nada. Pero quería volver o entrar en un me parece muy interesante el aspecto amoroso, puramente amoroso, porque veo en este triángulo, porque la mujer, esta mujer que arroja luz en la vida de los dos protagonistas, tiene afectos, digamos, hacia los dos, hacia tanto el Joe como hacia Frankie, como hacia el personaje que tiene esta incapacidad. Entonces, el amor en la novela tiene como una doble función, que es, por una parte, redentor, curativo, en fin, digamos que, como decía, arroja luz y da un pequeño toque optimista al libro, pero por otra parte tiene lo contrario, tiene una parte entre la relación, ella introduce entre los dos también una cierta tensión, en fin, la aparición de los celos, etcétera. Era la introducción del amor en la novela, o sea, triangular, o sea, esta doble faceta, ¿es intencionada o surgió así, te lo pidió la novela de modo casi involuntario? Es decir, ¿buscabas que tuviera por una parte luz y por otra parte también entorpeciera la relación entre ellos dos?
Maybe it was not so much the introduction of love that created the problem and the fate of this dark fate of this friendship, but it was perhaps the introduction of this female character, which is not synonym with love. And I think the character of the girl called BJ Eilander, she's from South Africa, probably saved the book, but because with her a certain deepness arrives, somebody who with the darkest ghosts in her soul goes about with these three boys, and in the end they all submerge into her loins. They all lose their virginity with her. And the one, she doesn't stay with Joe Speedboat in the end, because he's way too too much of an anarchist. She doesn't stay with Frankie, for he's in a wheelchair. I mean, he has a brilliant mind, but he has his problems. But she stays with the one who provides order, who provides her with a house. So in the end, she's wonderfully, how to say that, opportunist. She's a great opportunist, and she knows the way of the world, and she teaches them, because she is way ahead of them. And I mean, it's always a great danger to introduce the dark character as the female character who scatters the order. But And this was something that was not much reviewed on, but her problem is, I mean, I never mentioned it in the book, but she is clearly a borderline patient. And when you know this, how you define a borderliner, you can actually read the whole world literature and find your borderliners everywhere. But it wasn't too interesting to call her that, so I gave her interesting actions instead of an interesting psychological failure. But I think in her failure, she's incredibly wise and she knows the rules of the world. And as I said before, I like the way that she admires his intelligence, which matches her intelligence. And I don't. When I make up a character, I try to have as little ideas as possible. I just want to have them go their own way. And the moment when she says that, and I didn't expect her to say that, but it suddenly happened. She said, "Well, as I said before, intelligence is very sexy." Then I knew, yes, you're onto something. Which gives him a sexual identity as well. And it ends. The book ends with, well, it's not really ends, but with this, which I thought it was a very beautiful vision, because she is a borderliner and she has this problem of eating too much and vomiting in order to stay thin. But she's not thin. She's a Rubens-like girl, and she wants to be thin, and he wants to be strong. So the highlight of their sexual life is when he lifts her up with one arm and she feels very light and he feels very strong. And I thought that was quite a good vision.
La verdad es que es una escena hermosísima. Quisiera, ya para terminar, entrar en un asunto un poco más extraliterario, que es la propia recepción del libro. Como digo, el libro ha tenido un éxito, en fin, sin fisuras alrededor del mundo en muchas de sus traducciones, pero he leído algunas reseñas y te lo había comentado antes al autor, pero hay algo que me ha sorprendido sobremanera y es que por el hecho, en primer lugar porque hay personajes, digamos, fuera de lo común. En segundo lugar, porque como decía, es una novela con imaginación, con ficción en el sentido puro de la palabra, pero sobre todo porque los personajes son adolescentes. En las reseñas que he visto fuera se ha dicho que era lo que los ingleses llaman un crossover, un libro que está entre la literatura para jóvenes y la literatura para adultos. No entraría yo a recomendarles ni orientarles en las lecturas que tienen que leer sus hijos adolescentes, pero quizá este no es el libro más adecuado. Entonces, no entiendo, quería que comentáramos en público cómo la crítica, la necesidad de taxonomía, de categorizar, de poner cada cosa en su casilla, limita la propia interpretación del libro. Y en este caso, aunque las críticas han sido todas positivas, a mí me ha irritado especialmente esta definición que además, según creo, no se ajusta para nada ni al espíritu del libro ni al libro en sí mismo, ¿no?
Well, it proves only one thing, and that's quite a limited vision, if you say something like that. And there were two or three critiques in Netherlands which stated this, and I was furious. I thought, well, can't you think properly? Get your head straight. But it was my first encounter with this enormous amount of critiques, and when I wrote the book, I was a very, very happy but very, very unsuccessful writer. Unsuccessful in the sense that I had more publishers than readers. And which is true, I had three publishers that wanted to publish my books, but I could actually, at the time, I could actually really say when somebody said, I read your book, I could say, well, that was you. That's so, and suddenly, this book, which I never think about readers when I write a book. And when I wrote this book, I thought, who the hell will read a book like this? I couldn't imagine these elder ladies reading it or liking it. I couldn't. I thought, why would they read it? I thought it would be too much of an adult novel for youngsters and too much of a young novel you know what I mean. And I desperately tried to think of another title. I thought, Joe Speedboat, nobody's going to read that. So I was not very optimistic when it came out. And suddenly I thought I had a fake grenade in my hand, but it really exploded. And to my great joy, of course, but then you suddenly get all these funny remarks, like it reminds of the world according to Garp, or comparing it to Paul Auster. But these, I'm not such a big fan of Paul Auster, and but I realized what the best strategy was to comments: shut up and dance. There's no, let the people write what they want, and it will all be necessarily for the best, as Mr. Pangloss says. But then again, it's a limiting idea that it should be a novel for this or that, and in the secrecy of my mind, I oppose to it.
Yeah. Sí, la verdad es que también quería comentarte las comparaciones del libro, como decías ahora. En algunas críticas vi que te habían comparado con Salinger, que bueno, no está mal, aunque tampoco le encuentro mucho los puntos en común. Pero con Paul Auster tenías la mala suerte de que esta es una novela estupenda y te comparaban con una de las peores novelas de Paul Auster, que es Mr. Vértigo, porque había también un adolescente y tal, que es una novela que había que quemar ahora mismo. Entonces, ahora vamos a dar... nos hemos comido un poco del tiempo, pero si ustedes quieren hacer alguna pregunta en cualquier lengua, en español, ya tenemos ahí al grandísimo escritor Martín Solares, que levanta la mano desde atrás. Cualquier pregunta, en fin, aquí está el autor para contestarles. No sé si tiene un micrófono o... Sí, pues cuando quieras, Martín.
Gracias. Bueno, quiero decir que estoy asombradísimo de la popularidad de Tommy Bieringa aquí. Se me ocurrió decir en voz alta que yo tenía una copia en español de su novela y de repente alguien entró a la habitación de mi hotel y se llevó la copia de la novela en español de Tommy Bieringa. Sí, o sea, entraron a mi habitación hace unos minutos y se llevaron esa copia. Estoy asombradísimo. Yo sospecho de varias personas que estaban en el restaurante mientras yo dije eso en voz alta. Pero cuando empecé a investigar en la recepción, lo más asombroso es que me dijeron que la persona que vieron entrando por ahí, merodeando, corresponde a la descripción de Tommy Bieringa también, ¿no? Y como él está escribiendo una novela sobre el doble, sobre el doppelganger, yo le tenía que contar esto inmediatamente, ¿no? Estoy asombradísimo de... Hoy hablamos de la influencia de la novela y de la literatura en la vida de uno, pero esto ya no puedo creerlo. Bueno, y quería preguntarle a Tommy... Si esta novela, Joe Speedboat, fuera un animal, ¿qué tipo de animal sería?
It's a very interesting question. I'll answer that. But first thing is, I'm sorry I got into your room. I'm not used to do that, but I needed a copy of my book because I didn't bring a copy. And then I went to the bookshop in the Santa Clara Hotel, and they said, no, sir, we cannot lend you one of your books. You have to buy it. And I thought, well, I'm not going to bloody hell. I'm going to buy my own book. I'll return it to you in a proper fashion. I said, no, sir, you can't. You get a discount of 15%. And I thought, bloody hell, I didn't come to Colombia to buy my own book. And then I realized that you had a copy with you, and I knew it would be on top of the shelf, so I made only one move in your hotel room, which is like that. I'm sorry, I will never do it again. Okay, but now, if it was an animal... It's a dog lying on warm asphalt. I'm not so much of a dog lover, but this is the only idea that comes to my mind. A dog lying silent and on warm asphalt. It's not the best answer today, but it's the only thing I can do.
Se aceptan preguntas sin acusar primero de robo, ¿eh? Está permitido. Pues, si no hay más preguntas, ya sabía yo que
sí,
va a confesar bueno, Martín que le deja sus llaves a todas las strippers de la ciudad y así no tiene ningún control de la habitación.
Sí, no, quería aprovechar para que Tommy nos contara un poco también cuál es su definición personal de novela, ¿no? Si tuviera que describir el género de la novela a alguien que jamás ha leído una o jamás ha estado en contacto con una, ¿cómo se lo describiría? Y además, ¿cómo subrayaría las virtudes de una novela por sobre otros géneros?
Well, the novel, I thought of that the other day because, well, the question is raised in Holland. We have a very right-winged government nowadays, and somebody asked me the question, what is a novel? What purpose is the novel nowadays? And I thought, well, maybe it's trying to weaken, to warm these cold, cold hearts and try to move them into the direction of empathy. This is, of course, very... this is utopian. I am not so much... I don't have a strong belief in what the novel can do, but I do know that the only genre, what is the word genre in genre? The only genre that really is capable of this long, long identification with a character, with somebody's troubles, with somebody's the things that make him move from the deepest of his soul. What is this identification? A movie cannot do it. A movie can do it only in a short term. But the novel can actually do that for the time you're reading it. For now, I'm identifying myself with somebody from the Habsburg Empire, for I am reading Radetzky, the Radetzky March from Josef Roth, and I am identifying with somebody in the end of the 19th and the beginning of the 20th century for almost a week now. There's nothing else that can do that, only literature. So that's quite something, I believe.
Voy a aprovechar y hacer una pregunta como si estuviera en el público, no voy a bajar por no cansarme, pero me interesa una cosa porque a raíz de la pregunta de Martín, después de escribir una novela con personajes grotescos o ligeramente monstruosos, quisiera saber qué estás escribiendo ahora, porque no sé si estás escribiendo la vida de una monja que ha perdido la fe o de un señor que no le pasa nada en la vida. O sea, me interesa mucho saber en qué personaje estás ahora después de haber hecho unos personajes tan marcados como lo era esta novela, ¿no?
that there is a slight problem, and of course I love to mention the name of Gabriel García Márquez here in Cartagena, but whenever he finished a novel, and I told Martín this afternoon, whenever he finished a novel, he writes in one of his short stories, he wants to run out in the street and say, how in the hell do you write a novel? Because he's forgotten how to do it, and you're a beginner every time you start again, which is, you're never experienced. You're never experienced, so you always start from zero. And I just started from zero with a novel, and I don't know what it's going to be like, but it has this beautiful character called Pontus Beg in an Eastern Europe town. He's a chief of police, and he's becoming older. He has one warm and one cold foot, and he has all the benefits of a character with many layers. So I think, this is an interesting encounter for me. But then again, it's a lot of work to be done in Eastern Europe, a lot of research. But I'm thinking of actually cutting back on research, because the things that I, and now I counter myself, things that are written without research are often better. So. Was that?
No. Do you want to read the paper?
Oh yeah, this one you mean?
Yeah.
I brought a short story, which I presented to the mayor of Cartagena de Indias, and he was very happy with it. He said, "I will read all your books and give them to all my friends." So this is what I gave to the mayor. It's called Room 18. And it starts out in Copenhagen, but don't be confused. It will go to Cartagena. Room 18. This is a story from... it happened 21 years ago when I was in Cartagena, traveling, doing nothing, trying not to be the international antipatico I was. But I wrote it about a year ago. Room 18. Copenhagen is bright and cold as an operating room. Only after 24 hours in this city, where the people are handsome and unscathed, does Suzanne come strolling into my memory. She was from Copenhagen. I met her a dizzyingly long time ago in Cartagena de Indias, Colombia, where she was sitting on an old gray rampart looking out over the sea. It was the third time in 2 days that I'd seen her. It was time to stop for a chat. But before I got the chance, she said, "Come to the Hotel Regina tonight at 8, room 18. By the time 8 o'clock arrived, centuries had passed. On the stairs to room 18, I was stopped by an old woman. "Come with me," said the woman, and led me to her room. She pointed to a stool beside the bed and poured two glasses of brown rum. Salud. Her name was Sonia. She was an English teacher. Her life had come to a halt in that little room amid textbooks and a vanity table with weather-stained mirror. "You have dry skin," she said, picking up a pot of aloe vera salve. With thin paper hands, she applied it to my face. I reminded her of her son, she said, as she rubbed the salve on my forehead. "And you're a writer without a story. That's a terrible thing. Find a story." After the second glass, when she felt that I not only looked like her son, but also more and more like her late husband, I left. I was a man expected. Room 18 was at the end of the hall. The wooden floorboards creaked. Through a crack in the door, light was shining. I squatted down and looked into the room. The girl, Suzanne, was lying naked on the bed in yellow light. The bed was swayed like a hammock. A fan was whisking on the ceiling. She had a towel wrapped around her hair. Perhaps she had fallen asleep after a bath. She had broad shoulders and breasts that called my name. "Coming," she shouted when I knocked on the door. She got up off the bed and walked to the bathroom. I was dizzy with happiness. She was of the same flaxen glory as Anita Pallenberg, the muse of almost all the Rolling Stones. When she came out of the bathroom with a sarong around her body, I rose quickly to my feet. I fell asleep, she said in the doorway. Come in. That was then. Now I'm in Copenhagen, where the cold rain lashes my cheeks and forehead till I turn red. Somewhere in this city is Suzanne, who first showed me her body and then her soul, transparent and turquoise as a fjord. Find me, she says. Thank you so much.
Para ya se acabamos. Nos han quedado muchas cosas en el tintero, aparte con este pequeño problema técnico que hemos tenido al principio. Me hubiera gustado preguntarle por sus libros de viajes. Me hubiera gustado preguntarle por Miyamoto Musashi. Me hubiera gustado preguntarle algunas otras cosas. Pero solo tenemos tiempo para darle las gracias. Gracias por la charla de hoy, sobre todo gracias por el rato que he pasado con tu libro, lleno de, a veces, cinismo, rabia, dolor, pero también humor y mucha literatura. Muchas gracias.